Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
Come down
Swanfield
and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
Mo Salah, just absolutely unbelievable at football. Liverpool Football Club tweeted it last night. LeBron James tweeted his wholehearted agreement to that sentiment. Really, it's just a basic fact of life. And that goal he scored yesterday will go down as one of the great Premier League goals in one of the great Premier League second halves, I think. Brilliant stuff in the new Global Clasico. City Liverpool rarely disappoints, and it didn't yesterday. Welcome to today's Second Happens Football Podcast. Hello there, Ken.
Kieran, how are you?
I'm great. How good was that yesterday? You may have noticed I stole your description of City Liverpool as the new Global Clasico from your piece in the Irish Times today.
Oh, yeah.
And it does make as much sense as any other matchup in the world, I suppose.
Did I put global?
Oh, I don't know if you did or not, but I mean...
I just hate that word, global.
You hate the word global? Okay.
No, I just
find as the new Clasico from your piece
to stay away. I just try to stay away from that word.
Okay.
But okay.
Leaving that aside, the global is implied, I suppose, given that we're talking about what used to be Real Barca, the game that everyone around the world
was interested in. Well, it's very sad, of course, what's happened to Barcelona and, of course, to Real Madrid. Mm. Both defeated over the weekend. Barcelona 2-0 by Atletico Madrid. Luis Suarez doing his telefonando celebration. scored a goal and then seemed to try to make a phone call to someone using his hand, which I don't think anyone can really begrudge from that. And Espanyol beat Real Madrid on the world's most informed player, Karim Benzema, 2-1. So yeah, it was Madrid versus Barcelona in Spain and Liverpool versus Manchester in the Premier League.
Mm. Another dark weekend for Manchester United supporters as well, as the vehicle which Ollie is at the wheel of chugs unsatisfactorily on. What is that rattling I'm hearing?
Fantastic.
We'll be hearing from Gavin Cooney of the 42.ie and Miguel Delaney on the show a little later on. It's also the start of the month, which means there will never be a better time to sign up for the Second Captain's World Service. So for a show delivered to your ears every morning, just go to secondcaptains.com. It's £5 a month, depending on where you are in the world.
It's a whole new way of doing journalism. It's brilliant.
Where we will be in the world next week is in Berlin at the Pre-Europa Media Awards. You might remember that a few weeks ago we told you that our Second Captain's production with the BBC, Where's George Gibney, got nominated for one of the most prestigious international awards in media. Now the Pre-Europa Festival takes place in Berlin next week, and we're all bloody well going, and we're going to record the Second Captain's podcast from Berlin all next week. So, not only are we celebrating the Pre-Europa from one of the world's great cities, with thanks to our friends in Aer Lingus, but Second Captains in Berlin means one thing and one thing only. It's Synth Week Live, everyone. Get working on your own synth bangers like Early to the Dance Floor, because we'll be playing them out next week from the home of synth. Stay tuned to the World Service all this week for more info. Can you believe this is actually happening, Ked? It bloody well is. So does a list of truly great Berlin albums: Low, Heroes, The Idiot, any Einstürzende Neubauten album you're having yourself. You will soon be able to add Ken's Report on Sport, the latest edition of which you can hear right now.
Is it really the home of synth?
Are you going to tell me it's like Dresden or something? Just come on.
Düsseldorf, I would have gone with.
You would have gone for Düsseldorf, would you?
Yeah, I would have.
Well, do you want to hang out in Düsseldorf for a week, or would you rather Berlin?
I've been to Düsseldorf, actually.
It's hell of a town.
Well, I am tremendously looking forward to it. I'm not sure on which day.
Düsseldorf.
Of five.
The Ruhr Valley's fourth most interesting city.
I'm not sure on which day of five the pre-Juno Europa Prize will be handed out. I suppose we've got to go and just wait and see. Wait and see what day.
It's a festival. It's a meeting of media minds, Ken. I mean, the fact that we're only doing 4 days is in itself a bit of a tragedy, but nevertheless, I mean, you have to go over, you have to sample the full experience. I mean, it's a meeting of Europe's greatest media minds. We have to be there. Quite frankly, what have we been doing all our lives until now?
Yeah.
Not going to the pre-Europa, but that glaring omission has been rectified for 2021.
Yeah. Well, I'm tremendously looking forward to next week. However, this week... Down to business, I suppose, Kieran.
Down to brass tacks.
What was going on over the weekend? Well, the game yesterday.
What jumps out? I mean, at the end of the day, it has to be Liverpool City because it was a bloody entertaining, like unbelievably entertaining second half in particular.
The first half was quite poor. Really, it was pretty flat. You thought, well, this is not really. We're getting excited, but I was sitting there thinking, what am I gonna I really hope something happens, because nothing has happened which is worth writing about. What am I gonna say here? Like, is there anything to say about this? You really miss Trent Alexander-Arnold in a game like this, don't you? I mean, that was considered. There were certainly foundations were dug on that particular but then, you know, in the second half some things started to happen. And it was. I mean, I think actually we should just play a bit of the Klopp audio, because you'll probably have seen Klopp's interview or a bit of his interview after, which I thought was unusually good with Jeff Shreves. Just in terms of, he seemed to get needled by Shreves saying something that always pisses Klopp off, which is suggesting that the team lacked a bit of energy, which Klopp always hates. Like, it's like, you gotta say that. You know, because even if it's true, like it's like, no, we must not ever admit that we have low energy. So he then started to go into this quite detailed explanation of what he thought was going wrong in the first half for Liverpool, which we might as well play a bit of now without me describing any more of it.
You play Man City, and Man City with the ball is a proper team. But they obviously, how we saw in the second half, ways to defend it. What you have to do, you have to close down the decisive spaces. For that, you have to step out in specific moments. So you need. So what does City want to do? They want to play through the center. First idea. But if the center's closed, they go. They leave the two wingers high and wide. Pass the ball there. If it's a big switch or just a pass, one situation's going in the box. Whatever, these kind of things. We never close. I'm not sure. I saw a lot of games where City could pass the balls that easy through the half spaces. So between our winger and eight, it was constantly. Poof. So what's the reason for that? We went a last line to passive. We called the midfield line back. So neither Hendo nor Curtis could really step out when needed, when necessary. So we were just passive. They passed the ball through us. They turned, and from there we go. They had chances, clear, but they didn't score from that. But what it gives you is a really bad feeling. This bad feeling leads to not playing football, what we didn't do as well. So then we had these long balls which make absolutely no sense. One or two of them maybe made sense. All the rest, well, not really. I didn't see the reason for it. And obviously all these things we changed in the second half. Immediately you could see we set it up, we were higher, we were more aggressive in this situation because we felt closer, we felt more compact. So they couldn't play anymore like they wanted. So we were now in the game, we scored wonderful goals with the ball. The message for the football was play the extra pass. We didn't do that in the first half at all.
So yeah, I thought that was, I mean, what Klopp was saying there to begin with is he's essentially describing, as far as I could see, one incident in that first half in particular, which was the one where The one that culminated in James Milner being booked for hauling down Phil Foden for like, well, maybe it was only the second time, but it was definitely the second bookable offence, I thought, that Milner had committed on Foden. Because,
and not the last time. Yeah.
No, well, this, you know, it was a game where, okay, it started off, I think Liverpool played, you know, started off fast. City, you were wondering what City were going to do because, you know, after what they'd done at Chelsea, which was kind of just all follow Chelsea into the corners and pin them back in their half and force them to give the ball away as they couldn't play out of defence. Were they going to try something similar against Liverpool? The answer was no. They were a lot more passive to begin with this game. But as the atmosphere sort of began to die in the stadium after an initial big, City just started to take control. I mean, these things, I suppose, are related. And eventually, after 15 minutes or so, the only sound that could be heard was the City fans taunting Anfield about how quiet it was as City passed the ball around. And whenever Liverpool got it, they would kind of give it away. They tried a lot of these diagonal long balls, which you heard Klopp complaining about. And gradually, City started to create chance after chance, and was all happening down the side where James Milner was up against Phil Foden. And he's not just up against Foden. Foden is the cutting edge. There's also Grealish, who was playing kind of centrally, but really looking to play Foden in. Cancelo, Bernardo Silva, Kevin De Bruyne, even Ederson at one point is looking for the pass to Phil Foden, who can just beat Milner at will. Like, there's no, it's impossible for Milner to stop this guy. And it was a real mismatch that you were kind of looking at as this first half went on, thinking, how can you just let this happen to James Milner? He's a good man. How can you let him be destroyed in this way? And aren't you a little bit concerned that this is going to lead to a goal? This is what I was thinking. The thing that you're wondering when you look at that, looking at this Milner fun thing, is how much are they going to let the game flow here? Because it's the only thing that Milner can do is kick Foden. So how long is that going to be allowed to continue? And the answer was, well, a lot longer than you would have expected.
It is kind of mad when you put it like that. It's like, why are we giving the advantage to James Milner in this situation? You know, why are we shaping the game in a sympathetic way to a guy who's getting destroyed like that?
Well, you got to give him a sporting chance, I suppose. You got to make things interesting. You know, if you just let Foden run past him willy-nilly and Milner can't even kick him. I mean, what kind of a contest is that? You know, that's not fair. So quickly, Foden was, I can't remember the order of whether Foden had the shot, which was saved by Alisson. This was from the incredible Bernardo Silva dribble. Remember when Bernardo Silva took the ball off?
That was first, I think.
Yeah.
Before the tackle started flying in.
Henderson sort of dithering on the ball, is robbed by Silva, who then starts running around in circles, ingenious circles, being pursued by Liverpool players, but always sort of managing to keep his body between them and the ball, and then manages to get in. Nutmegs Virgil van Dijk, who goes down amid the crashing of timber, and then plays in Foden for an easy goal, which is saved by Alisson. It's a great save. Foden then got in and was chopped down by Milner, or was taken out by Milner at the edge of the box. I thought outside the box, although I saw Jermaine Genus make the point that as there was no effort made to play the ball, this should have been a red card. I'm not sure. I think it was probably a yellow card. However, it wasn't even given as a foul, which was the interesting decision that the referee made there. It was like, well, okay, that's not a foul. I mean, so VAR presumably looked at it and concluded that, okay, this is obviously foul, but it's outside the box. And as VAR doesn't award free kicks, you know, they would, what I'm saying is they must have looked at it to see if it was a penalty and then concluded, okay, it's not a penalty because it's not inside. It was clearly foul.
Mm? Yeah, but just to be clear, they could have brought it back for a free.
No.
For a free kick.
No.
Situation.
No, they don't. They don't award free kicks. VAR doesn't give free kicks.
Yeah.
I mean, VAR
it's pretty odd.
VAR could have said, we think this is a red card. You know, Jermaine Genius thought that. And then they could have said, we think you should send Milner off. You should have a look at this or whatever. But they can't say, no, it's not a penalty, but it is definitely a free kick. Because the play had continued. No foul had been given. And that was it. But, you know, you can see this situation developing. It's like, okay, well, this is going to happen again, because every time City get it, they're trying to give the ball to Foden, and he's just effortlessly beating Milner. Then, there was another one where he got away from Measley, put the ball over for De Bruyne to head it over. There were a couple of others. And then there was the one where Milner pulled him down. That was the moment that it struck me that Klopp seemed to be talking about when he talked about this, get the ball into the sort of half spaces, turn, and then play it to the winger. It was Grealish who was played in sort of between Liverpool's midfield and defence. Grealish turned, played it to Foden, and Foden was in past Milner, and Milner just had to pull him down. That's the yellow card. And at this point, you're like, okay, well, now Milner is like, he could get sent off at any moment, and the very next play,
it's nearly a mercy substitution now. He's got the yellow card, so you're able to say to him, listen, you've got a yellow card, that's why I'm taking off.
It's
not
just because
of
that bastard
you're
ref.
Getting destroyed. Exactly.
It's the ref's out to get you. The ref's gunning for you, James.
Yeah.
Now, you don't want to take him off in the first half. Like, you know, it's. I mean, Klopp did do that before with Dejan Lovren when he was being destroyed by Tottenham a few years ago. But he left him on, and he thought, well, this is really risky. Ederson then played that long ball to Foden, again in behind Milner. I think Alisson stopped that one. That was the one where Alisson came out and sort of tackled Foden like a defender would. And then it was half time. So it was kind of a miraculous escape from Liverpool that they weren't losing at that point, having been really outclassed, because they had done nothing in attack. The City had totally controlled the game, and Milner had been completely destroyed. So I assumed that, well, Milner will be taken off at half time. And when he came out for the second half, I just thought, well, this is really asking for it. Like, how can, you know, how does he think this isn't going to result in disaster? And it absolutely should have, because first of all, there was the goal that Manchester City, that Foden did eventually score, which involved him effectively getting away from Milner. Now, you could argue that there's a lot of players who should have stopped Gabriel Jesus as he kind of wove through and passed out to Foden. Milner maybe had to tuck in there, but then Foden had plenty of space. And then Alisson, for some reason, kind of stands outside his goal a little bit. Wasn't good by him. But okay, Foden has finally got his goal, and there's still plenty of time for Milner to get sent off, which then on 73 minutes, I think it was, clearly should have happened. Like, how this doesn't result in a red card is just... Bernardo Silva somersaults in the air and lands on his head.
Yeah.
Like, that was the really eye-catching thing about this. It's like, you've just knocked a guy spinning through the air who's landed on his head.
Get him off the field!
And managed to get away without it being a yellow card. That is... especially because the whole... Like, a friend of mine would say, well, this is crazy. You know, why is everyone talking about this? Didn't you see Bernardo Silva committed another foul 10 minutes later? Bernardo Silva was booked. Then he committed a foul on Salah. Arguably could have been sent off 10 minutes after this, you know, down by the touchline. Nobody's talking about this. Why does nobody talk about this? You know what I mean? Well, first of all, no one was getting sent off after Milner had not got sent off for that. It would have been like if City would have walked off the field. You know, if one of their players had been sent off for a second yellow and Milner had got away with this. And you see Guardiola's reaction to this. I mean, you could say that
volcanic is probably an understatement.
It was, but then it was the Milner foul was at 1-1, and then Salah scored that unbelievable goal for 2-1. And at this point, it was like Man City or Pep Guardiola here. This is going to be the most monstrous injustice of his career, as far as he's concerned. if they lose this, at this point, he is not going to have the words to express the rage that he is going to feel after this game if they lose. Which, of course, I say we were spared, but I kind of. Not that
the post-match interview would have been.
It would have been something really special.
One of the funniest things
you saw. Did you see his celebration of the equalising goal? The Pep Guardiola celebration. Of the
that was
goal.
That was aimed at the Liverpool bench.
It really was.
It?
Like he did. Yeah, he did. He did. He got out just so they could have a good view of him and directed it at them. You know, just so they knew that. And you know, you couldn't sort of help but feel, you know, this is a guy who really has felt like he's been up against it for the last while. Like, imagine you're in that position. You come to Anfield, you totally dominate, everyone's doing well, the plan is working, bang, you sort of concede a goal out of nothing. Oh, that's a, you get back in the game. And then there's just everything about the whole previous 70 minutes of the match had been leading up to the point where Milner inevitably got sent off, right? Inevitably, he's going to get sent off. And then he does and he doesn't. You know, what kind of a thing am I watching here? What's actually happening here? Like, you saw Klopp immediately after, for some reason, literally seeing Milner commit the sending off offense made him go, "Oh, actually, this is Gomez. You've got to go on." What took so long to do that? And what must Gomez have been thinking? Gomez is sitting there going, "My God, you know, it's not so long."
Milner's out there playing like he's got a death wish, and I still can't get a game here.
I still can't get a game. Like, everyone in the stadium can see it. So that's what made it so glaring, is that it had just been it had been the story. And that was the logical culmination of this story. And everyone, including especially Guardiola, is like, there we are, finally, that's what we've been looking for. This is, you know, now it's 11 against 10. We've got 20 minutes to win this against 10 men. And nothing happens. Unbelievable. And then Salah scores his goal. And Salah's goal is, I think it's his best goal that I've seen him score. It was phenomenal. And what I thought was, it was kind of funny as well in the context of what Klopp said in that clip that we played. What was Klopp's message to the players? Play the extra pass. And Salah just is like, actually, I'm just going to not do that. You know, like, Klopp was like, look, we just need to play the extra. I mean, play the extra pass basically meaning don't rush. And find the teammate who's in a better position than you. You know, this is effectively what, I mean, it's a kind of a basketball idea, right? Like, in a basketball, a game where you're on a timer and there is an incentive to sort of get the shot away, but oftentimes that shot will be better if you can play the extra, you know, if you can just keep your composure and find there may be a teammate better place than you and be thinking about that possibility. And, you know, as opposed to like, oh, there's the goal, I better shoot. You know, which you got that sort of very rushed, panicked mentality from a lot of the stuff Liverpool had been doing, in contrast to City, whom City, if anything, go too far in the other direction. You know, especially when they play this kind of
midfielders job.
Yeah, you know, and you're kind of like, well, okay, this is good, and you are controlling, but at the same time, like, there needs to be a bit more. I mean, in fairness, they could say, well, look at all the, Foden had chances, and we did have chances at Bruyne. Just, you know, the finishing wasn't quite there in the first half. But this is what Klopp said his instruction was to do, and Salah's just like, or I'll just dribble past them and score. Or, like, I'll dribble past Cancelo and play in Mane. You know, and then I'll just dribble past four players. I mean, if the initial sort of turn takes them away from two, and then the roll of the studs. And I'm a sucker for that move, I have to say. When a player rolls the ball with the studs of one foot and then quickly controls it with the other foot to beat the player on the ground, I mean, that's beautiful. And then from there, it's quite straightforward, I suppose, for him to do what he did to Laporte. But then the finish with the right foot is exceptional. So, I mean, an amazing goal, amazing timing for him as well. I saw Give Salah was trending. In other words, Give Salah Give Salah the contract.
Whatever you want.
But it is true. I mean, you know, I think we'll talk to Miguel about this later because I think his view is maybe a bit different. But I kind of did feel like, you know, okay.
You know, I was watching the game with Frances Murphy yesterday. You know, to her credit, would often express dismay at the amounts of money floating through the game. It was actually her that first brought to my attention the fact that Mo Salah's contract is still very much up for negotiation. She was telling me this.
Yeah.
You know, he's negotiating for a new contract. Pay him whatever he wants.
Absolutely.
She's like, absolutely got out the window. Years of fiscal rectitude. Just thrown out the window. Just give the man whatever he wants.
Like when the Pope said it was a disgrace that Milan paid 13 million for Lentini.
Oh, well, she was definitely on the side of John Paul II at that stage. Mm. Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Things change. The church changes. Francis Murphy changes.
We've seen a lot of inflationary pressures in the game. You know, Liverpool's turnover, I think, was 490 million last year, and this was partially affected by COVID or whatever. It'll probably be a little bit lower than this year. after their full season with no fans in the stadium. But still, you know, if you're to, if Mo Salah was to earn 20 million, that's like 4%, over 4% of the turnover. Does that seem like an outlandish sum, considering he is, you know, the franchise player? I mean, where would they be exactly without him? I suppose they would have another player in the team instead. But, you know, if you look at his contribution this season already, it has been phenomenal. And I don't really think he shows any signs of slowing down. You know what I mean? Like, he's clearly in pretty great shape. And, you know, as we've been talking about recently, you look around and you see this is a kind of a... It's a reality in football now that you get, like, older players... who are performing a lot better than their equivalents of 20 years ago were able to do, whether it's accumulated injuries, whether it's, you know, different fitness techniques, sports science, whatever it is.
I think there's also probably a lot of game knowledge that helps players out to, when it comes to scoring goals.
You know?
I mean, it's not all energy. It's actually just be in the right place. Like, run smart, not hard.
Hmm.
And that's the sort of thing that actually... And, you know, given the fact that they're not getting the, you know, the Achilles tendons whacked off them by defenders for the first 10 years of their career, it actually makes sense. It makes a lot of sense, actually, that at 33, you're just a much smarter footballer, a much smarter striker than you are at 23.
Yeah. The game knowledge used to get purged and weeded out of the game by injuries. Mm. You know what I mean? Because they're always kind of... And also, like, the drinking and all that kind of stuff, all the stuff that football players used to do... Or, like, sometimes they used to... Of course, I drink 2 pints of milk a day and eat a steak. You know, I want to build myself up, you know? And like, why are my muscles coming apart at the age of 28? You know, all this kind of stuff. I think you are seeing that. And as players, maybe you're slowing down. But are they even really slowing down that much? Like, this is a sort of strange aspect of it. You know, I mean, the laws of aging seem to have been suspended for certain... I mean, okay, there's always... You've always got your Alexis Sanchez cases as well. You know, you've got, like, players who do kind of seem to hit a wall.
Alexis Sanchez, Harry Kane. You know, those types of
examples. Oh, no, well, you did it!
Yeah. That's harsh. It's extremely harsh. That last remark should be stricken from the record.
Yeah. No, but it's true. But, like, it does seem as though Salah is in a, you know, he's missed 3 games through injury in four and a bit seasons. And one of those was a concussion. You know, no way would he have sat that one out if it had been up to him. So I think he's had 2 games where, like, he's had a, there was the one where he was tackled by Choudhury, the Leicester player, and I think he hurt his ankle. And this is like that, they're the only injuries that he's had. So this is kind of phenomenal. There's no, you know, it's no guarantee that it's always going to be that way, but it is a kind of a characteristic of these players who are able to go on for a long time is that they haven't been injured much. I mean, think about Ronaldo. I mean, his only injury that I can recall in his entire career that kept him out for any length of time was just around the time he signed for Madrid and he had some ankle problem. Other than that, like, no problems. You know, Ibrahimovic had the cruciate ligament at the age of 35, but before that, you know, and this is the reason, I guess, why this is why they've had this durability. Lewandowski, similar.
Can we move it on to Manchester United, or have we already said all that needs to be said about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as Manchester United manager?
I mean, we'll talk a bit more about it with Miguel again, I'm sure.
But this, like, is a story. I mean, you know, this reasonably good first half performance sometimes leads to goals, sometimes doesn't. Then second half curdles in an extremely frustrating fashion. Nothing happens from the bench, and it's a disappointing home result for Manchester United. I mean, this is a tale that has been told quite a few times before.
Yeah, I mean, there were some interesting variations to the tale this time, which is that Solskjaer, first of all, left Ronaldo on the bench, which was interesting. Ronaldo obviously came on when they were winning, left the field at the end, having not done very much, but very ostentatiously showing his frustration with what had happened. you know, just in case anybody thought that he was happy with a 1-1 draw, which I guess they probably wouldn't have, even if he hadn't sort of made this sort of theatrical display. You know, I thought, I mean, Cavani needs to play some of the time, and I think probably deserved to play. I mean, remember he helped him out big time when he came on against Villarreal. Maybe people doubted whether Solskjaer even had the authority to sort of bench Ronaldo in this way. Now, obviously, it makes sense to bench him because really what everybody understands that with Ronaldo, the main thing that he wants to win is going to be the Champions League, right? So you're kind of, you know that you will have to sort of preserve him. Or what he really wants to win is going to be the Champions League. And ultimately, you want to preserve him for those important games, which ideally are going to happen in the second half of the season. So you do have to, at some point, rest him. I mean, I think that Ronaldo probably understands this as well. You know, I mean, I don't think that towards the end of Madrid, even he was playing every minute of kind of league games, which he doesn't consider that important. And okay, Everton at home is a game that Manchester United usually win. Although Everton under Benitez have been playing well and have proven themselves a fairly tough team, you know, with a lot of speed, particularly. I mean, it was ultimately that quality that got them back into this game and nearly won them the game.
You'd have to admire Fred's dedication to fair play, though.
Well, you know, I mean,
just twice. Just what I can see what's the right thing to do for my team, but what's the right thing to do for my sport? You know, only more players were able to ask themselves these tough questions.
James Milner could really learn a lot from Fred.
I'm a holding midfielder. I know my job. But is my job actually just so horribly corrupted and unrecognisable from the game that I played as a young boy in Brazil? I mean, at some stage, someone has to shout stop. You know, if this is your game, then you can have it, quite frankly, says Fred. Yeah. You know, I want no part of this. No part of this game. Forget about it. On you go, Demary Gray. Go see what you can do. Self-actualization. See what you can do on this grandest of stages.
Yeah.
And to be fair, Demary Gray did the business.
He did do that. Decore and then Andros Townsend once again. And Andros Townsend showing that the Ronaldo celebration, I actually admit that I've never tried to do it myself.
Mm.
I don't know if you have, Kieran. You may have.
No.
Maybe roll out Sing Street.
No, that's... You don't
knock
get
a,
I really
knock a free
feel like
over
that,
the bar and then suddenly...
Yeah. I really feel like that's not something that would go down overly well.
You don't think...
Even with my teammates, to be honest.
Just a display of respect, as Andrew Townsend said, a display of respect. I've grown up watching this guy, I think Townsend said. Like, what age are you, Townsend? I thought you were 30 or
he's
so.
He's 30, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay. I suppose if he was 30, then he was only 12, I guess, when Ronaldo made his debut for Man United. So, okay, fair enough. But it turns out that it's actually more difficult to pull off than perhaps it looks. It you know, there's quite
you
a lot
have
of...
to, you have to plant your feet first. You know, I mean, you just have to, you know, get your step, fall in step correctly before the jump. You need to be in, you need to be balanced before the jump so that you can land balanced.
Yeah.
What Andros was trying to do, he was still running and doing it. He was in like full running stride, which meant that arms and legs were all over the place.
They were all over.
He was disappointed in himself. He was disappointed in himself. He said in a post-match interview that he didn't really do it justice.
Yeah, was he? I think the idea probably just occurred to him as he ran. I'm not sure if he was planning to do it beforehand, or he maybe would have nailed it a bit better. You know, worked on the core stability and all that sort of stuff. But like, it is interesting though, isn't it? How that becomes a focal point for the opposing players. You know what I mean? Like the sort of circus surrounding Ronaldo, it becomes a sort of a thing that they feed off. You know, I got the sense that was very much the case with young boys, for instance. You know, like, remember their celebrations at the end were just like,
yeah,
absolutely. I mean, okay, young boys beating Man United is a pretty big deal, whether or not Ronaldo's there. But, you know, like, again, you know, Solskjaer is in the position, like, it's this weird situation where I feel like all the fans of all the clubs think Solskjaer should stay. The Man United fans, you know, are like, Solskjaer is doing well, and all of the sort of rival fans are like, yeah, he's doing great, why don't you sign him up? You know, it's a weird situation in that sense. There's a sort of protectiveness towards him, I feel. And over the next while, you know, they're playing more difficult matches. But these are the kinds of matches.
Looking at the teams that they've played, I mean, and considering the fact that so many of the other teams around the top of the table have already played each other, United should be top of the league, you know, with given the quality of the opposition that they've played. And now they have Leicester, followed by Liverpool, followed by Spurs, followed by Man City.
Yeah.
And, you know, and with two games against Atalanta in the Champions League in between.
They're playing Liverpool as well, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Liverpool, I said, yes. So Leicester, yeah. Atalanta, Liverpool, Spurs, Atalanta, Man City.
Yeah.
At the end of that, I mean, you know, we have had these situations before with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer where it looks like you're entering a crunch period and he manages to wriggle his way out of it. But, I mean, I think this is very definitely the crunch period. But funnily enough, these are the games that he often gets results in.
That's the point. That's the reason why he's still there. You know, I mean, he's still there sort of 3 years later, nearly 3 years, rather, I should say, after taking the job. Because of his habit of winning these games. Okay, not the Atalanta is really important, because if they got knocked out in the group stage of the Champions League, he's in big trouble. I think, you know, when you look at a Champions League group that doesn't really have a headliner. You know, the last time they got knocked out, PSG were there. You know, and Leipzig are kind of a well funded club. This time, Villarreal and Atalanta, I don't think are quite there. And Young Boys, you know, who they've already lost it. So Atalanta, I think, is really make or break for him. But he does have Ronaldo, who is the, as Juventus thought, the cheat code for this competition. I mean, in fairness, he has been scoring goals. He scored in each of the games so far. But yeah, it's... I would agree that this is a big period for him coming up. The other thing I just want to mention was PSG managing to lose to Rennes without having a shot on target, even though they had Neymar, Messi, Mbappe, and Di Maria all on the pitch. I mean, so Pochettino's like, the first person responsible is me, says Pochettino, which I think is going to be his
a widely shared view. that's going to be a widely shared view as well. He's going to find a lot of nodding heads, I think, in the dressing room there.
We feel as though that was probably your fault. But, you know, and maybe it was his fault, because the change that he made in this game was taking Herrera out and putting Di Maria in. And I guess the idea was, well, look, you know, it is only Rennes. They're no great shakes, and we should be able to wipe them fairly easily. I mean, the change that he made from the Man City match. So effectively PSG went from kind of 7-3 for the setup, like a, you know, seven defensive oriented players and three attackers, to kind of a 4-2-4, and with the result that they lost 2-0, didn't have a shot on target. And if you see the second goal that Rennes scored, it was immediately from the kickoff for the second half. It's just an absolutely shocking goal. For someone like Pochettino as well, to see his team concede a goal like this, literally he must be like, how he's managing to sort of maintain his composure in the face of this disgrace. Because it's like, you know, if you think about him, when things were going well at Tottenham, they had that amazing kind of, they had great sort of fighting spirit. Like, they were a team that really put a lot of intensity into the game and played with a lot of passion. I mean, you know, their iconic game to me remains the 2-2 disaster draw against Chelsea, when they blew up, lost the title. Like, everyone should have been sent off. You know, Pochettino was pretty much in there, going, eyes bulging out of his head. It's kind of hard to believe that he now finds himself managing a team that allowed this goal against him, which was just they ran kickoff, they kind of moved down the right side. And PSG are sort of running back, and then PSG's defense are running back, and then there's just the ball pulled back to the penalty spot, and a guy runs in and just kicks it into the net completely unopposed. Like, there's nobody, and the four guys, you know, Messi, Mbappe, Neymar, Di Maria, are all just kind of standing in midfield, like, watching this. And this is what happens when you've got four guys who are like, well, you know, I don't really need to run back. Like, you can't play 6 against 10. You know what I mean? Even if you are, like, this is Ren. Like, it's not like 100 Japanese school children.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they are actually professional players. And if you do give them an almost two on one advantage, like, it's not going to work out for you. So, major disgrace for PSG. But the other thing to note was that They were, of course, all at a massive party on Friday night with Cindy Bruna, the model. I was reading about it in the Daily Mail. Cindy Bruna was celebrating her 27th birthday. And Neymar was there, Mbappe was there, Verratti was there. And everyone looked like they're having an amazing time, being an unbelievable sports failure cliche. So we'll see how much more of that we get over the coming months.
I said, Karen, it's Richard Keys. Prehistoric banter.
Please, it was just banter.
Is not acceptable in a modern world.
Do you have any regrets?
None. There are some dark forces at work here.
The eyes have it. The eyes have it. Unlocked.
Well, Miguel Delaney and Gavin Cooney join us now. Miguel, you were lucky enough to be there yesterday, Miguel, at Anfield, the Coliseum, to see what some people are describing as the new Clásico. Leaving aside the question of whether this really is the number one game in world football, I mean, which it clearly is, it's sort of a boring question. The question here is, why do you think these teams manage to produce good games so often? I mean, you know, these rivalries often don't, you know. I mean, I think the obvious Turkey rivalry is the one between Manchester United and Liverpool, where the games are always terrible, or have almost invariably been terrible. But the pattern in this rivalry has been for really open and exciting matches. Why do you think that is?
I think it primarily comes down to the two coaches. They both play fundamentally attacking football, and it's also a case where what styles make fights, really. We're just the different ways they play feed into these great occasions. Like with United Liverpool, I almost wonder as well whether, beyond some of the managers that have been involved, and like Mourinho, say, United for so long, and always shutting those games down, it's always felt as if kind of the tension of their much longer rivalry just kind of suppresses the occasion. Whereas this, the rivalry, there are some similar dynamics, and that's a Manchester-Liverpool thing. There has been bad blood between fans and sometimes the teams. Although after the game yesterday, Kevin De Bruyne and Salah were engaged in a very kind of a lovely discussion after the match. But it's all kind of subservient to the way the two managers are set up. And that's just created some really raucous games. And as you say, the highest level of football, or club football in the world right now. And that's possibly not a coincidence, given that they're at the very least two of the three or four best managers in the world.
Yeah, I think it's mainly due to the fact that so many of the other leagues are in such disarray, or there's only one kind of rich team that isn't falling apart in each of the other leagues, whereas the Premier League at least has got a couple of relatively stable top teams still in it for now. What do you think about it, Gav? What do you think is the secret of this thriller? I mean, maybe you think I'm overselling it. You know, some people have pointed out that there was a first half in the game as well, which wasn't very good. And it was really only after the second half that everybody had got excited.
First half is tactically intriguing, I think, is the official description of the first half. No, I completely agree with Miguel. Really interesting point about, you know, the fact that the history between United and Liverpool kind of ruins the contest. Whereas this, maybe, you know, maybe fans don't go into the ground worrying, oh God, what if we lose this game? It'll be terrible, me turning up to work on Monday morning, etc., etc. And it's primarily down to how Jurgen Klopp attacks these games. Like, he had a good quote a couple of years ago. It was a press conference in which I think he was effectively trying to advise the other 18 teams in the league on how to play against Man City. He said, there's no point sitting back. It's like trying to win the lottery. So it's just the way they go full throttle and go for the throat, which they actually only did in the second half. I think that's really why the first half was a bit of a washout. But I think it's primarily down to that, and to make a blindingly obvious point, down to the quality on the pitch.
The one thing I'd say about the first half, I think the first 10 minutes were actually really dull. It looked like we're going to set up kind of one of those boring nil-alls. But I thought the first half was quite fascinating from that, when it was as if City basically realised that Milner couldn't attack them in the way Trent Alexander-Arnold does, and that he was going to be basically swamped. And like it was fascinating in retrospective to see just how much City used one area of the pitch and one player to basically try and condition the whole game, and then how Klopp would get out of that. Now, again, that changed at halftime. It became a different match. But Klopp didn't change it by taking Milner off. He basically changed it by suddenly kind of almost remembering how they'd beaten City before, which was taking the game to them and storming them.
Yeah, but it was just Salah, though, wasn't it? I mean, it wasn't Liverpool. It was Salah who did that. You know, he was the only player who made the difference. It was him who made the difference. You know, like the goal, the first goal that they scored came out of nothing, because Salah decided to beat Cancelo and got away, and suddenly he was in the defense. I mean, obviously the second goal, but these were really the only two clear openings, insofar as the second one even was an opening, that Liverpool created, and they were both just because of individual quality from Salah.
I do think they played higher up the pitch. I mean, also just before the Salah, the run for the Mane goal, which was, I mean, watching at the time, I thought it was like Messi against Switzerland or Maradona against Brazil in 1990 to set up Di Maria and Caniggia. But before that, Matip had basically played the ball straight through City's midfield.
Oh, to Jota was the other one.
Yeah. That Jota chance is really the first where the first signal the game was changing.
Yeah, well, what is your take on that, Gav? Because, okay, Miguel's making the point that Klopp sort of rescued Milner not by taking him out of the game, but by changing what was happening in the game with other tactical changes, which is, I suppose, a more sophisticated way to solve the problem than just taking out a player who was clearly struggling individually against his opponent. But I do have to, I kind of feel like I need to point out that actually Milner was right there on the scene when Foden scored his equalising goal and then should have been sent off moments later, and how he didn't get sent off was a miracle. So really, that decision should have blown up in Jurgen Klopp's face.
Yeah, Milner should have gone at halftime. I think Klopp and Liverpool definitely got away with that. Klopp said so many interesting things after the game, but one of the things he said was, and he stopped himself from swearing, but he was going to say, play the effing extra pass. Mm. Because Liverpool, like the way City set up in the first half, they didn't press Liverpool as aggressively as they pressed Chelsea the week before. They sat off them a little bit and allowed them to play the ball to Matip. And then the way they had kind of constructed their press, City seemed to press higher down their right-hand side than the left. And Liverpool just couldn't play through the City midfield. And I think the reason for that was because Milner was at right back. Because like Liverpool's whole game plan of going full throttle means everyone on the pitch throwing themselves into challenges and pressing without worrying about what's behind them. But I think all the Liverpool players played knowing that James Milner is the 35-year-old old man, is down at right back. And if we play the ball through midfield here, we'll lose it. They'll hit a quick diag to Phil Foden, and Milner will get destroyed and potentially sent off before half time. So they did push up more aggressively in the second half. I think they did exactly that. They played the extra effing pass as Klopp wanted to in the build up to
except for Mo Salah, who just decided to not play any passes.
Oh no, but I mean the pass to Salah, even for the first goal that ended with Mane streaking clear and putting the ball past Ederson. They finally played through Fabinho. They worked a little triangle on the right-hand side of the pitch. It was the first time they did that. I thought City pressed Fabinho really well in the first half. Like, it happened so often. The ball would go to his feet and he wouldn't even be able to turn to look the other way. He'd just roll it back. So I thought that was Liverpool just being slightly more brave on the ball and worrying less about the impending disaster that was unfolding in the right-back position.
So, Miguel, where do you stand on the big question of the day? I mean, Salah obviously was produced this incredible performance right at the moment when his contract negotiation is sort of the major unsettled question, I guess, at Liverpool at the moment. What are they waiting for?
I suppose what they're waiting for is who blinks first, because there's such a huge distance between what Liverpool or what FSG are willing to offer and what Salah wants, given he feels basically he should be the best player in the Premier League, best paid player in the Premier League.
Which means getting paid more than Ronaldo, which is unfeasible, surely.
Or at least, I think the latest line we heard was getting paid as much as Kevin De Bruyne. So that would be over 300,000.
Which sounds reasonable.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously, you know, leaving aside the whole moral question of saying, well, of course he's, you know, we're speaking about a player who, we're speaking in terms of the market rate for these top footballers. And he is at that level. So, you know, why shouldn't he expect to be paid at least as much as De Bruyne?
And probably the transformative player of, obviously Van Dijk took them up another level again. But the signing of Salah a few months before that, it did feel like it took the Klopp era up a notch and kind of completed that attack. He's been the most consistent outstanding player. Right now, this always comes up when people are looking for a contract, but he is on the best form since April 2018. That was the last time he had such a prolific run of form. I think it was 9-9 then as well, and now it's 9-9 at the moment. And like my feeling even watching that game yesterday, I mean, first of all, it was one of those where like you do feel it was a privilege to see it live, and mercifully I'd looked up and saw the whole goal go in, because too often with those goals you look up halfway through only to realize that they're happening and have that kind of regret that you miss it. But this, I mean, it was up there with one of the best I've ever seen in the Premier League. And it's kind of like it was that performance level where it's a player really kind of pushing the boundaries of what he's capable of and confident in absolutely everything he's doing. And I suppose he's 29 now. So going by how football has basically been run for the last 20 years, one potential rationale from FSG is you don't give big contracts, or at least long contracts, to players over the age of 30. But and allied to that is, at the moment, there's not that much of a market for Salah, because the big plan on his career was to go to Real Madrid post Cristiano Ronaldo and be the dominant star there. But that was scuppered by their signing of Eden Hazard. And even though it hasn't worked out, Madrid are now all about Mbappe and Haaland. Mm-hmm. So that he, and just because, I suppose, as you've mentioned there as well, the economics of European football right now, he is very short of options. But contract is up in a year and a half time. Say Mbappe goes to Madrid, that might create an opening for a PSG, say, who are one of those clubs willing to pay those contracts. So it's maybe risky from FSG from that point of view. And also there's the fact that even though he's 29, well, the modern trend in attacking players basically suddenly to be, or sorry, these kind of uber athlete modern stars is to go until their late 30s. And given how well Salah looks after himself, you can see when he takes off his top. There's nothing to suggest he can't do the same.
What do you think, Gavin? I mean, Liverpool gave a 4-year contract to Virgil van Dijk, who recently blew out his knee. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if you think he looks as good as ever. I'm not sure if the balance is quite the same as it was, but they showed they're giving you, you know, he's a bit older than, I think they're born the same year, himself and Salah, but he's a little bit older, and they gave him what he was looking for. So, you know, why can't they do this for Salah?
I agree. I think they'd be mad not to give him a contract at this point, because Liverpool don't have the money that the other three teams at the top of the Premier League have. They're more reliant on getting their decision making right. Like when they make big decisions, they don't really have the finance to write it off if it doesn't work. Like signing Salah is just an easier decision, because okay, you sell him, you then have to replace his goals, and that is exceptionally difficult to do. His injury profile is sensational. Like I don't think he's ever had a muscle injury since he's been at Liverpool since 2017. He had the shoulder that was destroyed by Sergio Ramos. There was a concussion that brought him out of the Barcelona game in 2019, the one game in which they did actually do okay without him. But I don't think he's ever missed another game through injury. And what is interesting, like one of the reasons why you kind of don't want to hand out big salaries to 29-year-olds is not necessarily because of themselves, but because of the wage inflation that they cause, the ripple effects that they cause around the rest of the squad. But it is kind of interesting that I think Liverpool have signed all the other contract renewals that they want to sign, like Alisson, Van Dijk, Robertson, Alexander-Arnold, Fabinho, Henderson. They're all signed, sealed and delivered. So they're like, if Salah was to if they were to smash the wage structure for Salah, they don't have to worry as much about their other main assets, to use a kind of a horrible phrase, knocking on Michael Edwards' door and asking, well, where's my increase? Yeah. So it feels like maybe it was even strategic on Liverpool's point of view to leave Salah to last. I don't know. But his goal record is unbelievable. And because the team are so efficient, we kind of forget how good Salah is individually, because they often put him in such good positions that they don't ask him to score the kind of virtuoso efforts that we saw against Man City at the weekend. So I know he's 29, but I think his injury profile means that his peak is probably later in his career than other players. So absolutely get him signed, I think.
What about from the City end of things, Miguel? How impressed were you with them? I mean, have you been at all three of their games in this epic week?
Yeah, this triptych, yeah.
Away to Chelsea, away to Paris and away to Liverpool. How impressed have you been?
They're better than I expected, I have to say, given how this season has started a little inconsistently, and they've kind of gone from these goal gluts to like nil-alls against the likes of Southampton, which is actually probably maybe predictable given their summer business and the lack of a striker. And it's something that also, it seemed to happen at Pep Guardiola at Barcelona by the time he got to his fourth year, where they had these strange games where if they got a goal early, they could absolutely cut loose in the way you imagine. But there was a capacity for frustration within the way they play, which is why maybe, even though I actually think there's a bigger argument over whether Guardiola's football is better with a false nine on the whole, I at this point and with the kind of where they are as a team, there are so many occasions they look like they could do with a finisher. The Chelsea game suited them in that regard because of the way they play and the way they completely pressed Chelsea in, and that give them no space to move. On Tuesday, I was kind of struck by just how ponderous and slow City looked in the Champions League. I mean, it is only a group game, so that it has to be kind of, you know, taken into account. But given it was Paris Saint-Germain, given there is that group has a slight edge in it with the way Bruges have started, or Brugge, as Jonathan would have said. Also, Paris Saint-Germain made them look their attack. I mean, I suppose this is obvious when it's Messi, Neymar, and Mbappe. But given these are two state projects, they suddenly made City's attack look so D-list. And Mahrez, Grealish, and even Sterling.
Do you think? I mean, did City not comfortably win on the old XG?
There was those two chances near the box, which are kind of, I think, and one of them was going to be ruled out anyway. But beyond that, it looked quite flat, I thought.
Well, I saw you were having arguments about this, as is your wont, when you said that Grealish was B-list or C-list or something like this, and people started to take offence on Jack Grealish's behalf. What exactly did you mean by that, though?
Just in terms of star profile and that.
Compared to Neymar.
Which is obvious. But I suppose the point being that when you do have limitless money, as these clubs do, it's suddenly striking that one of the two clubs has, you know, three of the four biggest stars in the world right now, or three of the five now, if we're counting Salah up there with Ronaldo. And the other has some Premier League players, which, I mean, you know, that's unfair.
You know that PSG were losing 2-0 to Rennes with a shot on target the other day?
I do, but I think there are strange dynamics to Paris Saint-Germain's season, which are going to continue right through, and these kind of odd waves, depending on... I mean, this is the other side of this debate as well. And what I did say on Tuesday, where City's attack looks B or C list or even D list next to Paris Saint-Germain's, but it's better to have a system than to have individuals without a system. And that's going to be an issue for Paris Saint-Germain all season. It's a bit like United in that regard. They're going to be dependent on the stars rising. Whereas what City have is a system that can make them better than the sum of their parts. And it's why they should overcome the lack of a striker and should make it work. But my overriding feeling at the end of this week, and from the first month of the season, I suppose, as well, is that City will obviously get up to 85 points or whatever it is again. But will there maybe this season a few too many games where they suffer those nil-alls or just don't have the finisher or don't have that break or get frustrated that cost the title? I mean, it'll be very close. I mean, Liverpool don't have City's strength and depth. And to be fair, at the moment, right, there's probably similar questions about, even though they've got Lukaku, there are similar questions with Chelsea in that they don't quite, they're not as fluid going forward as City are.
Yeah, no, they're not. I mean, and the question over whether Chelsea are going to score enough, I think, is, they obviously managed to do the business against Southampton, at least after the red card. But just on City, Gavin, I think, you know, Grealish was substituted in Paris. He was substituted again at Anfield. He was playing as a sort of a false nine, I suppose. I wouldn't say it was one of his best games. You know, I'm reluctant to criticize him because, you know, if you look at some of his numbers for this season, you know, he's been pretty good, you know, in terms of creating chances and all this kind of thing. You know, ostensibly he's been doing well. It sort of doesn't feel like that, though. Like, it doesn't feel as though he's quite sort of lit the place up in the way that, like, he had been doing at Aston Villa last season. I mean, when he was, I think in the first half of last season, he was clearly the best player in the Premier League. And okay, he hasn't been out at City so far. And I kind of wonder what's going to happen with him there, because it strikes me that his situation, there's this strange mix of Guardiola being a much more controlling coach than he's sort of used to, and sort of looking for all kinds of small details which he's going to have to learn and become familiar with, but also sort of sending him out in like unfamiliar roles where the structures around him aren't really very clear at all. You know, on the one hand, there's like this sort of the controlling Guardiola, and then there's the other, like, well, what are you going to do, Jack? Get out there. Yeah, of course you're false nine. You're supposed to be able to adapt to these situations. You know, there's a kind of a weird mix there, which to my mind anyway, at this point, he looks as though he's losing confidence a bit.
I didn't understand why he played against Liverpool, to be honest. Like, he's actually... So, what, Grealish actually kind of started more of a midfield role against Spurs in the first day of the season, didn't play very well, and has been quite good on the left of the attack. I mean, I think there's a stat on Sky before yesterday's game to say he's created more chances than anyone else in the Premier League, to which Harry Kane must be reading and recoiling in horror at the fact that he's playing Thursday nights in the Europa Conference League. But I didn't understand. Obviously, Foden was so good on the left-hand side yesterday. They wanted a bit more pace to go up against Milner. I don't really know why Grealish played. Maybe there's a good bit on Monday Night Football last Monday, which showed how well Grealish pressed Jorginho against Chelsea. Maybe he wanted him to do the similar job against Fabinho and probably did a decent job. But like, Grealish is never going to be the star that he was at Aston Villa, but just because Pep is the star. You know, you must always submit yourself to the brain of Pep. You know, I've kind of been surprised at how good Grealish has been for City and how disciplined he's been. Because the signing, like, it's a strange thing with City. It was like, they've all these forwards and all the forwards always look better when they're played either to the left or the right. You know, like, I thought Gabriel Jesus was a striker and Guardiola has turned him into a right-sided forward this season. So, like, I was always kind of puzzled as to why they signed him and why they spent so much money on him, because there was no obvious place in the team for him. I've been impressed with him on the left of the attack, and he's obviously scored that great goal in Europe. Hasn't really lit up the Premier League as he has last season, but you can understand that there are better players around him and thus it's more difficult to shine. But his role yesterday didn't really make sense to me, and he struggled to make an impression. I thought maybe De Bruyne might have been a better pick for that false nine position yesterday.
Just the thing about Grealish as well is what's basically happening now is what Guardiola always does when he brings in a new attack like this. This must get explained to them, because it's obviously going to be quite a taxing mental process, but they have to unlearn football and learn a new, almost, mental architecture of the game. That's basically what Guardiola does to them.
Yeah.
I think that's why it does happen a little bit. The players take a little bit of time to kind of bed into a system, don't fully look themselves, and then about kind of 8 months down the line, there's a potential explosion. The one thing that should be said, I do agree with Gavin that there's no obvious place for Grealish in the City side now. But then their argument has been that this isn't just for now, it's for 3 years down the line. They have the ready-made De Bruyne, the replacements. And also, this bigger thing actually is exactly what we've just been talking about, whereas they see, City realise they don't, there's not that much basically box office to their squad or the club beyond Guardiola himself. And Grealish is seen as box office. That did inform the signing as well.
Yeah, you were talking about Harry Kane, thinking, oh, he wishes he'd, you know, he'd join. I mean, we all know that he wishes he'd join Man City. What do you think Ronaldo thinks about it at this point, about his decision to join Manchester? Really, he was walking off, obviously grumbling about the game. We can't just talk about it's always the same sort of discussion with Odegaard and Solskjaer, so I sort of don't really want to go into the whole over and over again, because it's just the same thing over and over. But like, they're 4 points ahead of where they were at this point last season. I heard that point being made to him in his press conference after the game. You know, the start of the season seems like it's been bad. Maybe it hasn't been that bad.
It's not been very good though, has it? I mean, the performances, for me, United only played well in one game for any extended period. And that was against Leeds, who just play into their hands. And that was without Ronaldo, of course. I think I haven't been convinced by them once. Even went to the Newcastle game, the big Ronaldo return. And Newcastle, I thought, it could have been a very different game, but Newcastle had even a kind of 6 out of 10 finisher up front. And that's been the case in a few United games. But we're getting into the Solskjaer thing here. Mm. And Ronaldo, I mean, Ronaldo's a guy who, it was second season at Juventus. He got so frustrated with Maurizio Sarri's coaching. And Maurizio Sarri, whatever you think of him, he is one of these kind of modern coaches in a sense. He deeply thinks about everything. His teams are very well structured. There's a real kind of, a purpose to the coaching. It is modern stuff. And Ronaldo so disliked this that there was one moment where he just kicked the ball away in training, making sure everyone heard him, this is shit. Sorry, left at the end of the season. And it is one thing with United now, that whatever about the team and Ronaldo's performance level, the power dynamics have been altered. There was an argument that prior to the signing of Bruno Fernandes, who is a spiky character, this was quite, not a meek Manchester United squad, but really lacking in these sort of massive figures. And then Ronaldo comes in, and he's basically just, through his status, through his pay, through the way they got him, he's suddenly the most powerful figure of the club. And, you know, and someone who notoriously demands the best standards, who will let it be known when people are kind of dropping from what he thinks is top level. So one of the running themes through the whole Solskjaer era is basically that the players like him. And this is seen as evidence of good man management. But the players liking you isn't necessarily good man management, because basically people like an easy life. And there's been an element to that, that has been it's a good atmosphere, but not necessarily an exacting atmosphere. And that's what Ronaldo could bring now, just even on a subconscious level. Like I was thinking about this the other day, trying to put myself in the framework, say, or sort of put myself in the mindset of some of these United players, even if they have been kind of, there's been an element of coasting at the club, or just kind of, you know, because all this talk of how they're almost a vibes team, they do it when confidence is high, and then when confidence is low, they just naturally drop to that level, and there's no safety net in terms of the structure. Suddenly then you see Ronaldo coming in, you see the kind of standards he plays to, and everyone's thinking, hang on, is what we're doing actually good enough to match? Because naturally, it's the way these dynamics always work. Everyone wants to kind of rise to the level of the new guy, to impress this kind of this demanding new figure. And that could have huge repercussions, because then it will inevitably come back to the questions we're all asking, and that's been kind of, you know, dominating the show for the last while, or all football media, which is whether Solskjaer is up to it. And that's where it could cause further ructions for United. Because at the moment, Ronaldo, he's not come to this club to be fighting to stay in the group stage of the Champions League, something that could be possible. He's not come to play in the Europa League, and he's not come to try and scrape into the top four. He's come to come back to try and win everything.
Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer also said he's not here to sit on the bench, and that's exactly where he was at the, for the first, 56, 57 minutes of the game against Everton, Gav, which I guess shows a sceptical world who really holds the whip hand at Manchester United.
Yeah, maybe that was a sign of power, but then it wasn't much of a sign of power, because afterwards we're talking about, like, Gary Neville's comments were interesting when he was talking about Ronaldo's reaction at full time to storming down the tunnel puts more pressure on Solskjaer, which is actually, it's interesting when you hear Miguel talking about him kicking the Sarri ball away in a fit of performative anger. I think maybe he wasn't doing that at the end of the game against Everton, Ronaldo, but perception is reality, as Roy Keane would tell us. I suppose it all comes back to the Solskjaar debate, really. Like, and he's like, the fact that we're still having him means he's not going to be good enough at the rarefied level that United are competing at the moment. And I think the best metaphor to, or the best image to understand what Ronaldo's presence at the club does now is encapsulated in Bruno Fernandes bombing a penalty outside the Old Trafford stands against Aston Villa, put under more pressure by just the bare fact that Ronaldo is there standing, looking at how things are going. So, it all comes back to the Solskjaer debate, because the fact that Solskjaer is the manager just shows how United are being run at the moment. You know, they're completely in love with their own past and have been blinded by that to the extent that they're so tolerant to mediocrity. The midfield is too mediocre and the manager is too mediocre, and the manager has either not been given the funds to fix the midfield or doesn't identify the midfield as a problem. And both of those, one of those issues is true, and whichever one it is no less problematic than the other.
Well, I think he has identified it, right? I mean, I think he's been sort of agitating for that behind the scenes, and they've been like, shut up, Ollie.
He is also aware of what's wrong with the team. I mean, it's hard not to be aware of what's wrong with the team. But before they signed Ronaldo, yeah, he did want that defensive midfielder. But then, like, that just points to how all this is almost a study in kind of the direction of these sort of kind of massive mega institutions in these industries, and kind of the power dynamics. And that, while from what I've been told, Solskjaer's thinking on Ronaldo, because there obviously, if they actually really wanted Ronaldo, they would have gone for him much earlier in the summer. But it was the City pursuit that really sparked things. And from what I've been told, Solskjaer had initially been hemming and hawing, but then ultimately, having spoken to people like Ferguson, decided that Ronaldo gives us a better, even if we don't have a midfielder, Ronaldo gives us a better chance of winning. And I suppose that's almost something that's up for debate now as well. There was an interesting thing this the other day. Did you see Alex Kajelski, the Athletics editor, put up what I thought was a very informative stat on pressing movements in the Premier League?
Ronaldo was the bottom.
Yeah. And that led to kind of a deluge of responses, basically.
I agree with that. It was like the defensiveness about it. When it's not necessarily he's showing evidence that it's just a fact that Ronaldo has done less pressing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean Ronaldo is like the most useless forward in the Premier League. Yeah. It's just a fact about his style of play. But the defensiveness in the responses was off the charts.
That's exactly and the thing, the point about that as well is it feeds into this bigger debate in that when you have Ronaldo in that team, because of his physical stature now, because of his mobility at this point, you have to play a certain way, and that way will ensure Ronaldo scores, but it's not necessarily the best thing for the team as a whole. And it's interesting now, we're almost actually at the reverse of what happened when Ronaldo first broke through as a star, which is Ronaldo is now Ruud van Nistelrooy, and lads like Greenwood, Sancho are almost Ronaldo and Rooney of 2006, where there is kind of debate, would they be better served by having a more open and kind of, you know, a more angled attack rather than something that's all funneled towards one player. And I have felt this from the start that Ronaldo will outscore Cavani, of course, but Cavani, who's in superb shape himself, given he's in his mid-30s, given what we talked about earlier, just his sheer mobility suits United better. And the first 15 minutes of Saturday, I thought they were actually quite good. Now, they did trail off, and I think that points something else with United, which is they're almost kind of one of these adrenaline teams. They've got to go through these bursts, but it's not sustainable because there's not the structure there.
Yeah, yeah. Gavin, what do you think about, just on that subject to wrap up with Ronaldo's, I've seen people argue about this a lot already since he's joined, and the notion that he could have made them worse is actually, you know, is regarded as sort of blasphemous. But do you think it's maybe true?
I think there's probably a lot of truth in it. The team is too open. They're too easy to play through. I mean, Ronaldo will score 25 goals, but that doesn't necessarily mean United will score 25 more goals. You know, he'll take goals from Fernandes. He'll take goals from Greenwood just by the fact that he'll be standing in the penalty area. And the team is too open and too easy to play through. Like, they concede an average this season so far. They're averaging 12 shots against a game. Like, City are conceding half that. And United haven't really played anyone of any high caliber opposition at the moment. And, like, it's the point where I'm kind of now feeling a little bit of pity for Solskjaer that he's had Ronaldo foisted upon him, because he was given a 3-year contract during the summer, presumably because United are impressed by the piecemeal way he's putting together a team and building a team. And then later on in the summer, after the season has started, you're like, okay, Ollie, we love the job you're doing, but here's Ronaldo, try and fit him in the team. And like United, like, I mean, it's not a terrible idea for United to want to go back to the Alex Ferguson years, but they're doing it completely wrong. Like, they're embracing the personalities of that era rather than the principles, because it was one principle that ran all that. It was Ferguson was in control. He was the most important man at the club, and Tuchel and Klopp and Guardiola are the most important men at their respective clubs. The role of the manager has changed, but that fundamental fact hasn't changed. And Solskjaer isn't remotely the most important person at United. Ronaldo's more important than him. Ferguson is more important than him. He's still dictating transfer policy. Like, in what other world would you have a former player like Rio Ferdinand in the media helping the transfer policy along? Like it's a shambles.
They're almost the anti-City in that regard, aren't they? Now, I know City wanted Ronaldo, and a deal was very, very close. But the way City now, they don't have that focal point. They have multiple angles of attack. It's fluid in the system. Whereas United, all towards that one focal point. And even City, to be fair, their recruitment model is generally, other than what happened this season with the striker, but that's due to separate factors, I suppose, and the smaller market for striker. But usually everything is so planned in terms of transfers. There's always these, you know, successions in terms of positions. And United, okay, they have implemented something else, but it doesn't feel like City would just suddenly impose a player that he didn't need on the team because the opportunity availed of itself.
Yeah, although, you know, it's just a funny thing about that situation that of the two clubs, I think City were the ones that actually could have done with Ronaldo. You know, he kind of fulfilled an obvious need in their team, whereas with United, they're sort of moving people out of the way to accommodate him. And I don't know ultimately if it's going to work out as well as it could.
But just on that as well, actually, and this I give credit to Jonathan Wilson for this one. He raised it. But there's also an argument that Sancho and Grealish went to the wrong clubs as well.
Grealish should have gone to United. Why is that?
Because Grealish is a pure individualist, which suits United, and Sancho is a system player. Because I was talking to someone who knows Sancho a few weeks ago, and at that time they were concerned for him because he was in such a defined structure at Dortmund, where everything is kind of like there are triggers, when to pass, when to dribble. You know, it's very, there's a real kind of roadmap in terms of how to play. Whereas United is very much a case of, you know, go on, son, have a go, take him on.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's not a lot wrong with Man City anyway. They couldn't be solved by signing Raul Jimenez. What do you think? Is Raul Jimenez, who I've seen and I'm delighted to see returning to goal scoring, rumbustuous center forward form. In the last couple of weeks, when it looked as though, well, maybe he's not going to recover from this horrible injury that he had, maybe this is the guy that could solve all Pep's problems.
Yeah, it's one of those nice stories, isn't it? As well, as much as anything else.
Well, it was great. You know, I honestly the goal that he scored last week, the brilliant goal. I would have had a goal of the month, but I think they gave it to Townsend because they always give it to like a long shot. But he scored this great goal where he beat two defenders, sat the second one down, scored the goal. And then the celebration alone should win goal of the month, because just to see how much it means to this guy. But, you know, if you're looking for a centre forward who can play in the Premier League and, you know, could be... I mean, I know that the City, you think of like Wilfred Bonny and, you know, disaster signings like this in City's past.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just feel as though he's a really good player who could actually bring something that they don't have, that they do seem to be missing a little bit. And, you know, they're not going to be able to get Harry Kane, I assume, in January. Well, who knows? Maybe things will be so bad at Tottenham by then that they'll actually be glad to see the back from.
Well, they did have a little think about Danny Ings as well, City, in the kind of maybe the view that they could bring a striker in for a year as a stopgap. Someone in a game like yesterday, even just to change the dynamic of the attack and have a focal point for a little bit, or someone to kind of finish. But decided against it. And I suppose I was about to say there that what will put City off Jimenez is that he's 30, but then they did consider Ronaldo who's 36. But I do think it's there. It's again with City, it's a word they've used the club before in sacking managers, but they have a holistic view to transfer as well. And every even kind of short term signing is viewed and how it's going to affect future plans. And their future plans now are very much, I mean, Madrid think they're going to get Erling Haaland, but I think Mino Raiola has made a lot of clubs feel like that. Because he remains number one target at City as well. Once they realised Kane wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you guys, Miguel, Delaney, and Gavin Cooney. Thanks a million for joining us on the show today.
Cheers.
I know Alan's birthday.
20th of April?
No, that's Hitler and Shay Given and Steve Finnan.
And my mum.
McDavid is the 12th of April, which is easy to remember because of it's the...
Dave Letterman.
The Titanic. 68 years after it disappeared beneath the icy waves.
Yeah.
Owen McDevitt was born.
Circle of life, mate.
Is there anyone alive out there? Can anyone hear me?
Tuesday, 4th of February. We're nicely into February now. Let me just have a look at some of the birthdays today. Comedian Dara O'Brien, TV presenter as well, isn't he? He hosted Have I Got News Here, some of those programs. 48 years old today. Ex-boxer. I have to admit I'm not really sure about this man. Oscar De La Hoya. I don't know. I can't remember him off the top of my head. Anyway, he is 47 today. Sports journalist and writer and radio personality Ken Early is 41 today. Irish actor Patrick Bergen is 69 today. Now, Patrick Bergen, you
We have an email here to finish. It's from Tao Sharma. Thank you for your mail, of course, editor at secondhands.com. If you want to send us your thoughts, synth or non-synth related. Tao writes, "Hello, Second Captains. I wasn't surprised to hear Ken once again speaking condescendingly about video games
once
on Thursday."
Again.
Once again. "This isn't the first time I've heard video games looked down upon on the pod. It always makes me wonder, what is this subconscious hierarchy of games that matter? Is there a line being drawn between sports and games? Does a game need to exist outside a screen to be given value? I'm genuinely interested by the team's take on this." Ken, I should, and thank you for your email, Tao. Ken, I should let you know that the 29-year-olds, they've also been in touch.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not amused at old man early slagging them off for playing computer games, basically telling them that you had 15 years done down mine by the time you'd reached 29. What say you?
Angry, pompous old man. Well, I don't understand. What's the complaint here? I was basically saying that a father of two, Emiliano Martinez, was spending too much time playing video games. If he was spending 2 hours a day playing video games, which apparently he is, I consider it to be too much.
Right.
Others
have a different view. That's
for a family, for a family man.
Is your problem? Is your problem not with the man's age, but with his familial circumstances?
Well, you know, surely.
You've got a problem with the age as well. Then you do.
No, it's not. It's not really his. It's not really his age. You know, I mean, when I was that age, was I playing 2 hours of video games a day? Some days, sure. Was it an iron custom with me that I always did it for 2 hours every day? No, you know, it wasn't that organized really about anything.
If he sat down and read for 2 hours. Yeah, you know, yeah. Would that be a major problem? You know, what's the difference between sitting down and reading a book and sitting down and playing 2 hours of computer games? One is socially acceptable to the likes of you, Ken, old man early, and one is socially unacceptable.
Yeah, I mean, it may be, I may be partly conditioned by the fact that when I was a little lad, the computer games we had were socially isolating. They were not joined up with all the other little computer games being played by all the other little lads around the world. Whereas now, obviously, Martinez was saying he uses it to keep in touch with his friends back in Mar del Plata. So, you know, this is social. You know, maybe in past generations, Emiliano Martinez would have gone down to the local bar and drunk a string of tiny little coffees as he hung out with his friends, whereas now he sits there wearing a big headset and abuses them as he murders them or maybe leads them through the combat zone or whatever. I mean, look, I don't really have anything. I don't really have anything against video games. Look.
Okay, Tao. Okay, 29-year-olds, that's as close to a Kennedy apology as you're ever going to get. So that's pretty much it. Thank you very much for listening today. Join us on the World Service where we'll be chatting to you all week. Very excited about the Berlin news we were sharing with you earlier on. If you're anywhere on continental Europe, basically, we'd love to see you next week. More details, as I said, throughout the week. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kieran.
And thanks for listening, everyone.
What one is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade us of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.